This is Peter Fisher. Welcome to episode 6 of the General One podcast. The subject of today's podcast is the simple harmonic oscillator. I've decided that it would probably be best to have a couple of specialty podcasts that are not around a physics area, but more around a single topic or system. And this is the first of those. I think I'm going to have one on orbits and probably one on two-state systems. And today we'll talk about many aspects of the simple harmonic oscillator. If you'd like me to cover a specific problem or topic, please send me email to fisherp@mit.edu and let me know. So let's start at the very beginning. The simple harmonic oscillator, undamped, classical, can be modeled by an ideal spring that provides a restoring force in proportion to its displacement from its equilibrium position. This is Hooke's law and is described as a potential that's proportional to displacement squared. So one thing to always remember is that it's displacement, not absolute coordinate. The simple harmonic oscillator occupies a central place in physics for many, many reasons. It's sort of the simplest oscillatory system, and it's also the zeroth order model or first order model for the minimum of any potential. So if one has a potential that has a minimum, say at coordinate x0, then if one computes the force close to x0, the force is going to be proportional to the opposite of the displacement from x0 plus the opposite of the displacement squared times some constant, and so on. So there will always be a Taylor expansion around a minimum whose first term is the modeled by a simple harmonic oscillator potential. So if we start with sort of the canonical example, which is a mass that's moves back and forth without friction on a plane in one dimension and is connected to a spring of spring constant K and equilibrium length x0, the mass with a mass of mass m will be described by F equals ma, where ma is equal to m times the second time derivative of x with respect to t, and F is equal to minus k times the quantity x minus x0. You all know how to solve this. The solution is oscillatory and is some amplitude times sine omega t plus phi plus x0. So that's describing oscillation around the equilibrium position with phase phi and amplitude A. Since it's a second order differential equation, A and phi must be determined from initial conditions, and the oscillation frequency omega is equal to the square root of k over m. One of the remarkable things about the simple harmonic oscillator is that the oscillation frequency is independent of the amplitude. And I think it's kind of obvious that any other restoring force gives an oscillation frequency that depends on amplitude. That's pretty important for a clock, because as a clock winds down, the amplitude of oscillation of whatever is providing the oscillatory signal will become smaller. And as it becomes smaller, if the frequency changed, then the clock would change. Bear in mind, this is only true the simple harmonic oscillator is only a first order approximation of anything, but it's good that the first order frequency is independent of amplitude. The next most non-trivial extension to the simple harmonic oscillator is to add a damping term that's equal to minus B times X dot. It's a good idea to keep in mind what the units of the constants are. So the units of constants K are force divided by distance. The units of B, the damping constant, is force divided by velocity. When solving for the damped motion, one allows the frequency to be complex and tries a trial solution, for example, of the form x of t equals a times e to the I times the quantity omega t plus phi plus x naught. So that's oscillation, again, around the equilibrium position x naught. Substituting that in to the second order differential equation where MA is equal to minus BX dot minus K times the quantity X minus X naught gives what's called the secular equation, the oscillatory, or e to the I omega T plus phi cancels out, and one's left with an equation that's quadratic in omega squared, and then solves for omega and gets an expression involving B, K, and M, which can be complex or real. The part which is complex, when it appears in the exponential, gets multiplied by I, so it winds up being providing the damping part. And there is a second part which is real, which provides the oscillatory component. There are three cases: critical damping, under damping, and over damping. Critical damping is when you displace the system and it returns exactly to equilibrium as quickly as possible without overshooting. Underdamping is an oscillatory motion that's exponentially damped. And overdamping is an exponential return that's slower than critical damping. So as an exercise, you should be able to work through the damped simple harmonic oscillator problem, get out the secular equation, solve the secular equation, and identify the condition for critical damping, underdamping, and overdamping. It's probably pointless just to memorize the expression in terms of B and K, because there are also initial conditions, two of them. But it's good to drill at getting through it quickly. The third thing you really need to know about is the driven case, which a driving force of amplitude alpha times sine omega t plus theta is applied, and the response will be oscillatory at the same frequency, and the response will be largest at the resonance condition. So again, this is the solution of a secular equation that's a little bit tricky, because you wind up with a complex quantity in the denominator and have to multiply through by the complex conjugate so that you can separate into a real and imaginary part. The amplitude of that complex number is the ratio of the amplitude of the response to the driving amplitude, and you can use that to find the resonant frequency. The phase is the ratio of the imaginary part to the real part and gives the phase shift. And the third thing you need to characterize the resonance is the full width at half max, which one obtains by just setting the ratio of amplitudes to half of the maximum value. I worked through this. It's about 10 or 12 lines of algebra and of complex numbers. And again, it's something you should probably not memorize, but drill a couple of times and be able to get through quickly. So one problem would be, suppose you have a stereo system and the stereo speaker, which provides the sound, has a part that weighs say 2 grams that is going to be the oscillatory part that's driven back and forth, you want the system to be damped, to be critically damped for the best fidelity, and you want it to have a resonant frequency of concert C, which is, I think, 440 hertz. Anyway, 440 hertz is what I remember as the middle of the the logarithmic span of human hearing. So find the damping constant and spring constant you need to achieve those things. Now, you all know that there is an electrical analog to the simple harmonic oscillator, consisting of a resistor of resistance R, capacitor of capacitance C, and inductor of inductance L in series. And one can identify quantity by quantity the analog between those quantities, the current and charge, and the parameters of a simple harmonic oscillator system, with the charge taking the place of the coordinate, the mass taking the place of the inductance, the damping parameter B being played by the resistance, the spring constant is 1 over the capacitance, and velocity is the total current. Again, you should drill on being able to write down the differential equation for a resistor, inductor, and capacitor in series and substitute in the appropriate values for current. This is, of course, just an example of curl E equals zero. So you calculate the voltage drop for a current I flowing in the system for each one of those things. So as an exercise, you should solve the same circuit, or not the same circuit, but you should solve the similar problem where the inductor, capacitor, and resistor are all in parallel. And in both cases, assume that there's a charge Q0 on the capacitor at T equals zero, and that no currents are flowing. The simple harmonic oscillator plays an absolutely crucial role in quantum mechanics. It's the simplest bound system and is really kind of the basis for quantum field theory and comes up all over the place, Landau levels, places like that. Remember, we haven't talked about quantum mechanics, but remember in quantum mechanics, when takes a Hamiltonian and makes operator replacements for the canonically conjugate momentum and coordinate. So in the case of a simple harmonic oscillator, the Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m plus kx squared. And one thing you should remember and actually drill on is that the ground state wave function is a Gaussian, e to the minus, well, wave function is proportional to e to the minus x over 2 sigma squared, quantity squared. So I'm sorry, let me say that again. The wave function is proportional to e to the minus x squared over 2 sigma squared. And you should be able to substitute that into the differential equation that you get from the operator replacement for the Hamiltonian and extract the value for sigma in terms of K, M, and the ground state energy E, and then compute the integral of psi star psi from x equals minus infinity to plus infinity to get the normalization. If you don't know how to integrate a Gaussian, drop me a line and I can tell you how to do it in a subsequent podcast. There's a neat little trick. And once you know the trick, you'll just remember it. You should also remember that the operator replacement for momentum is h bar over I times the partial derivative with respect to x. And the operator replacement for x is, of course, just x. So that gives you the ground state wave function. One thing you can practice is substituting y equals alpha x to eliminate h bars, 2m's, and k's so that you can work with a much simpler partial differential equation. So this is what will get you the ground state wave function. Now, of course, you'll need to know about excited state wave functions and just be able to deal with the system in general. And for that, one makes a substitution to annihilation and creation operators. And for that, what you recognize is that you can write the Hamiltonian as 1 over 2m times the quantity p star minus root k times x times the quantity p plus root k times x minus some number. So p star plus root k times x is an annihilation operator and minus, and p plus k times x is a creation operator and plus. So you should be proficient at performing that substitution and being able to work in a basis where you talk about energy level, annihilation, and creation operators. To do this efficiently, you need to know the commutation relation between momentum and coordinate, which is just h bar over I, and you need to work out from there the commutation relation between n minus and n plus, which I get to be I times root k times h bar over m. Once you have those things, you can show that the annihilation operator applied to the ground state wave function gives zero, then use the Hamiltonian times the creation operator operating on the ground state wave function to show that the energy of the next wave function is equal to the zero point energy h bar omega naught over 2 plus h bar omega naught. And so by induction, you can show that every time you apply a creation operator, you get the next wave function up, and the energy increases by the same amount, h bar omega naught. The main thing with a simple harmonic oscillator is to just drill on all of these things so that you can do them quickly. Don't try to memorize, because there's so many constants running around that it will only be confusing. But just know how to just go through it three or four times and make sure you know how to do it. Now, in both the classical and quantum cases, one can extend the simple harmonic oscillator to two dimensions and three dimensions quite simply, and you should understand how that works and do everything in Cartesian coordinates. One interesting thing to do is, here's a little problem. Take a two-dimensional quantum simple harmonic oscillator, and so you'll have a wave function or a ket that's nm, where n is the level in the x-coordinate and m is the level in the y-coordinate, and calculate the angular momentum of that wave function. So you apply an angular momentum operator and solve the eigenvalue problem for the angular momentum. Now, you don't want to do this in coordinate space. You want to work in annihilation and creation operator space, or level space. So you need to work out the commutation relations between x and p in this space. So do that, and then for a general angular momentum value, calculate the energy degeneracy, if any, and make a little table or graph that has n along one side, m along the other side, and then angular momentum going up in each entry. Next, carry out the same calculation for the three-dimensional simple harmonic oscillator. There's another thing you can investigate, which is the correspondence principle, and there's a really nice way of doing this with the simple harmonic oscillator, and that's the following. So the classical simple harmonic oscillator looks something swinging back and forth with in a sinusoidal way with frequency omega equals k, root k over m. You can carry out the same thing for classical simple harmonic oscillator by saying, okay, I'm going to take the ground state wave function. So this is a quantum simple harmonic oscillator that's just would correspond to a pendulum hanging straight down. And I'm going to displace it by an amount x, a macroscopic distance, and then let it go. So you do this by substituting, you know, x naught plus x into the wave function for the ground state, and then computing the probability or the projection of that displaced state onto the state n. So when you move the quantum mechanical simple harmonic oscillator over by some amount, what you're actually going to do is you're putting it in a superposition of excited states. And you can calculate the most likely state for it to be in and the spread in excited states. Again, I think you can do all of this in state space rather than coordinate space. So another thing that's interesting to investigate is two coupled simple harmonic oscillators. You can do this classically by just solving the eigenvalue equation for the two coupled partial differential equations, or I'm sorry, second-order differential equations. Quantum mechanically, you can try one of two things. You can either assume the coupling is small and use first-order perturbation theory to solve the problem, or you can assume the coupling is not necessarily small and try to solve the problem exactly. See why this does or doesn't work. The case where you have many coupled oscillators is the transition from quantum mechanics to field theory, or classical mechanics to field theory. In this case, what you find is that you can begin to solve the problem if you treat the index of the oscillator I. So let's say that you have n coupled harmonic oscillators, where n is some large number, and you index each oscillator with some number I, and they're all coupled together. Picture a long chain of masses on springs. That index becomes a coordinate itself, a continuous variable, and that's really the transition to a field theory. In preparation for General 1, I wouldn't bother with this. That's really kind of beyond the scope of what General 1's all about, but it's a good thing to think about anyway. So a little bit of news this week. I looked at interactions.org and saw that Owen Chamberlain had died. Chamberlain was one of the discoverers of the antiproton and one of the professors I had when I was at Berkeley. I graduated in 1983, and he was pretty ancient then, and that was 23 years ago. He really was a pioneer at the Bevatron, which was the first accelerator, I believe, to get above a GEV, or a BEV, as they called it at the time. So it's a little bit sad that he's gone. The Sigma B and Chi B were announced to have been discovered at Fermilab, which is a nice thing to do. It's also Good to know that their press office is alert and in business. Wish I could say the same for other places. I spent part of last week at a meeting for the Silicon Detector, or SID, which is a detector concept for the International Linear Collider, which is a 250 or 500 GeV per beam electron-positron collider. The idea behind SID is to build everything out of silicon and really try to use particle flow algorithms to get exquisitely high jet energy resolution. I'm not quite sure why this is so important, but it is an interesting problem, and I'm sure I'll learn more. Some of you may know the ILC is the machine to be built after the LHC, and is supposed to continue our exploration of supersymmetry or whatever is found at the LHC. And many people are concerned that if it isn't hosted in the United States, will we, being the U.S., will lose our supremacy in high-energy physics. Speaking personally, I think we lost that a little while ago. And we'll see what happens with it. For the moment, it's a project that I'm pretty enthusiastically interested in. And right now is the exciting time, when everything's on the table and a lot of the decisions haven't been made. And you can think about doing wacky things like building a detector entirely out of silicon and tungsten and other very, very expensive objects. I was there with Dick Yamamoto and Ray Cowan, and well, found things pretty interesting, but still don't know too much. That's it for episode 6. Please be in touch with any questions or anything you want me to cover. My email address is fisherp@mit.edu. Next week, we'll be talking about relativity, the special theory, and maybe a little tiny bit of general relativity. In the meantime, keep it up. Remember, half hour a day. If you build that base, you'll be able to ramp up a lot right at the end and really ice this thing, which will be a big buzz for all of you. I'd like to thank Sheila Marston and her husband John, and Bonna Newman and Refs, and Homer Reed, who's also at Refs, and Sean Thompson for help with the website. We're going to try to post this to iTunes, I think, and so that will be an exciting thing. Maybe people outside of MIT will listen to this. So have a good week here in Cambridge.